So hi everyone, my name is Rohan Sant.
And my name is Daniel Olaya, and we would like to welcome you to another episode of the Aerospace Medicine Podcast.
On today's episode, we welcome two very special guests who are world leaders in aerospace medicine education, Dr. Ronak Shah and Dr. Natasha Cho.
Dr. Shah is the current director of aerospace medicine at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas. UTMB has one of the longest running and most prestigious aerospace medicine programs in the U.S., with over 80% of their graduates or past leaders going on to jobs within the aerospace medicine sector, including NASA, the Federal Aviation Administration, SpaceX, Axiom, Space Adventures, and Virgin Galactic. His background is in internal medicine and aerospace medicine. Having completed the aerospace medicine residency at UTMB and the U.S. Army Flight Surgeon course, he has also a master's degree in business administration. He served as the physician at NASA for 10 years, including time at Star City, Russia, and 5 years as the medical director of the Johnson Space Center before joining the UTMB faculty.
Dr. Cho is the newest faculty member at the Aerospace Medicine Division at UTMB and a current flight surgeon at NASA. After completing her undergraduate studies, she was in the US Peace Corps and Turkmenistan before enrolling at the University of Michigan Medical School as a Cook Scholar. She completed residency training in emergency medicine at Stanford University before completing the aerospace medicine residency at UTMB in 2015. Since then, she has been a NASA flight surgeon assigned to 4 ISS missions, including Axiom 1, which was the first all-private astronaut crew to the ISS, and has just been assigned her 5th mission.
Ronak and Natasha, thank you very much for your time and welcome to the Aerospace Medicine Podcast.
Thanks so much. Excited to be here.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Just to start off, if we're honest, your individual stories probably could spark a whole day's worth of conversation. And I noticed that both of you have taken slightly different tangential paths, but actually come along to the same sort of place, which is within aerospace medicine, and particularly the residency at UTMB. I'm interested in both of your journeys, as we usually are on the show. So, Ron, why don't you start us off? What brought you to aerospace medicine? How did that happen?
I think all of us who are in this field are here because we're passionate, we're inspired. And when you hear people talk about the fields of medicine that they've pursued, I think the folks who are most excited are those in aerospace medicine. There's just something that lights up in their eyes. There's an excitement about it. And for me, when I was a young child, like many other children, I was excited about space, astronauts, all of those terms, all those words. But then you grow up and you pursue careers. And at one point in my life, I said, there has to be a way to merge these passions. And that is probably a separate story unto itself. But eventually I discovered a road to the University of Texas Medical Branch, where we offered a 1-month course in July. It's an introductory aerospace medicine course. And I attended that course, and very quickly it solidified my interest. And I said, yes, this is exactly what I have been looking for. And so the steps I took thereafter were steps towards what I would call residency seeking behavior, doing things to make yourself shine as a candidate or as a prospective applicant. And I did not get in on my first try. And so I just continued to work hard, demonstrate my interest and the efforts there. And then eventually in 2009, I joined the program. So I'll pause there and let Dr. Cho tell her side
of
the story.
Sure. So I think, much like Dr. Shah, I grew up being fascinated by space. I am the product of 2 immigrants to the U.S. And so my first language was not English, actually. And when my mom enrolled me in preschool, they said, we really need your child to speak English. So by watching a lot of public television, to include Sesame Street and a couple of science shows on the public television network in the U.S., one day eventually saw a segment about NASA and about astronauts. And I think I was 5 or 6 at the time. And I was like, that's cool. Like, I want to do that job. Like, how do I get to float for a living? And my mom was really good about taking me to science museums and all this stuff growing up. So shortly thereafter, that turned into, hey, I want to work at NASA when I grow up. I didn't really have a good sense of how I was going to get there. The only types of people I ever knew about who worked at NASA were aerospace engineers. So I entered university thinking I'm going to do aerospace engineering, having no idea what that meant. I took a bunch of prerequisite courses and I'm like, I'm not really good at this and I don't like it. So for listeners who are, you know, in high school or undergraduate, I think one of the most important take-home points there is really pay attention to what subjects you enjoy. Because if you don't love what you're doing, you're not going to be great at it. You know, the day will have never seemed so long. And so by sort of doing that introspection myself, I switched my major to biology. Still not sure how that was going to get me to NASA. But by virtue of the lab I was doing research in at the time, someone mentioned, hey, NASA has this summer internship program in what they called astrobiology, which is kind of a mashup of like, you know, earth sciences and space life sciences and astronomy and physics and all of these things. And it was through that summer internship program that we got a lecture about space medicine. NASA actually hires doctors. You know, I heard about the UTMB program. And from then on, I was like, this is what I want to do. This is, like Dr. Shah was saying, the perfect intersection of my interests in life sciences and medicine and space. And from then on, I kind of never looked back. Yeah. So I was super happy to, you know, ultimately make it to UTMB and absolutely feel like I have my dream job now.
I think already that there's so much value in those stories, the short stories that you've just told. For me, what stuck out was the phrase resident seeking behavior. I want to talk more about that. And also, Dr. Cho, that the fact that you actually tried aerospace engineering first. And I think there's so many people who go straight into aerospace medicine or are thinking about it from such a early start in their career. And it's really interesting that you had that experience and you had that learning beforehand. And I'm sure that added a lot of value to where you are now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, something else I counsel on students on all the time is it's just as important to learn what you don't enjoy as much as it is what you do
enjoy.
Absolutely.
Because,
you know, it gives you at least, at the very least, an appreciation for other people's jobs, because aerospace medicine is a huge intersection of disciplines, actually, because even though, yes, we're physicians, we interface a lot with engineers. We interface with a lot of other non-medical staff, managers, personnel that are responsible for scheduling or coming out with metrics regarding certain requirements for different programs and whatnot. So a lot of medical, non-medical interfaces. And so at the very least, as long as you gain an appreciation for what those folks do, it kind of helps you understand where everyone fits in the big picture.
Now, if I can add to that, it's true. There's a spectrum of information or resources that you need to support a space program, both from a medical and a non-medical standpoint. From a medical standpoint, if you think about the timeline from pre-flight to in-flight to post-flight, you know, we always talk about prevention is key and risk reduction in the pre-flight period. And we are incredibly, incredibly aggressive in the screening of our astronauts, not only at the time of selection, but on their annual exams, where in the United States, you have the United States Preventive Services Task Force, the USPSTF, which puts forth national recommendations for screening for certain diseases. We not only meet, but we often exceed some of those things. And again, risk reduction is greatest through prevention. When you get to the in-flight period, Dr. Cho can tell you what her experiences have been like supporting those roughly six-month missions. And the majority of what you see can be primary care, maybe urgent care related. And then you get to the post-flight period where you're talking about rehabilitation, musculoskeletal system issues. And of course, you have the dynamic phases of flight, such as launch and landing, where having insight into emergency medicine is important. But in the past 30 seconds, what we've painted here is a picture of the need for primary skills, preventive skills, emergency skills, all to bring it back to the point of you do need to respect the fact that it's not just one type of person you need.
I think you've painted like a really excellent picture from stuff that we're going to talk about a little bit later. So in Dr. Cho, you mentioned a specific internship that was there at NASA that gave you a little bit more information about what it actually entails and what the opportunities are. Dr. Shah, you mentioned that there was something in particular, but didn't expand. I'm curious, what was it that brought you to aerospace medicine and gave you the information that you needed to be able to then residency seek, as you so eloquently put it?
So that course, the principles of aviation space medicine, has gone by different names, PASM, the short course, what have you, but it is that course that we offer in July. And it's meant to be an introductory level course where we really just scratch the surface of aerospace medicine. And we bring in the experts, people who have been seasoned in this field from the standpoint of the FAA, military, spaceflight, what have you, to give a nice, well-rounded understanding of what goes into this field. And again, for me, that was it. That was the tipping point that said, this is what I want to do. I've been looking for this. It fits so nicely. It resonated so well with my desires. I said, I have found a way to merge my interest for space with my passion for medicine. And so thereafter, I was in private practice for a few years. But during that time, I became much more engaged in some of the things you may have already heard of, such as AMSRO, the Aerospace Medicine Student Resident Organization, which compared to today was really, really in its infancy. I also started to attend the Aerospace Medical Association annual conference, which at the time I used my personal vacation to go attend that conference. Really just the old fashioned way, I hate to say old fashioned way, of picking up the phone and calling someone, people who are alumni of the program, because if you think about how much the internet has changed and social media has changed in just the course of 20 years, it's a lot. So picking up the phone and calling someone and saying, I'm interested in this field. I was given your name and number. And everyone I ever spoke to, every single person, was more than happy to share his or her experiences. And each person had a different story to tell, much like we are just two people sharing our stories today. Multiply that, and you really get pulled into what's exciting about it, the passion behind it. And so between AMSRO, between the conference, trying to find faculty at NASA and saying, can I help you? Can I do anything? Can I pick up a project? Can I help you write something? Anything to be able to say, I learned more, I demonstrated my commitment, was beneficial.
Now, for those that aren't familiar with AMSRO, please tell us more and give us an introduction about AMSRO, please, because I think it's a great opportunity to introduce people to that all over the world, because it's not just Americans, is it?
Correct. So AMSRO, A-M-S-R-O, or the Aerospace Medicine Student and Resident Organization, is a component of the Aerospace Medical Association, or ASMA. And as the title implies, it's meant for those who are students and residents to get involved and learn more about aerospace medicine. What started off as a very, very, very small group of individuals has now grown to a multi-chapter entity with participants from both the United States as well as multiple countries all around the world. And I could not even begin to list the number of countries that have expressed interest and involvement. And that's what's also unique about ASMA as a conference. You have a very strong international participation in that event. So by engaging in AMSRO, it's a nice way for others who are interested to network and just learn more. There's a very famous saying, I don't know who penned it or coined it, but you do not know what you don't know. And using this as an opportunity to just learn more and more and more, and that aerospace medicine goes far beyond doing one zero-G flight. It goes far beyond one flight in a high-performance aircraft. There's so much more to it. The depth is so deep that that it gives individuals a chance to get involved. And one of the things we pick up on, you talk about AMSRO, what I like about it is a means or a conduit to get connected. I cannot tell you how many folks from around the globe have reached out to us at UTMB saying, can we work together? How can we get involved? What can we do? And so one of the things that Dr. Cho and I are working hard on is how do you enable global access to education in the setting of high demand, limited resources, and then you also have certain legal implications, right, of what you can or cannot share. Can certain people get access to military bases or the NASA campus, right? There are a lot of things to take into account. So I hope that answers your question, Daniel.
Absolutely. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I just wanted to reflect upon, again, a few of the things that have just been mentioned here, but it was about looking and seeking those opportunities. And then after that, as Daniel, I think, you were the one who coined this, I believe, which was like aerospace medicine is a small door within the world of medicine, but when you open that door, there's a big room beyond it. And it was quite a eloquent way, I think, of being able to attending this conference, for example, that Daniel and I have done as well, and I actually attended PASM. It just opens your eyes to just how big the world of aerospace medicine is and how collaborative it actually is as well. So if you can get yourself to those conferences, they are expensive. There are some scholarships available, though, to be able to help you along the way. But it is a really useful way of being able to understand what it is that you need to do to be able to get more within the sector, and also what the sector is about, and make sure that that is for you. So huge shout out to those particular organizations there. I'm interested then, you both attended there. So Dr. Cho, your journey to aerospace medicine was a little bit more convoluted, should we say. You did your undergraduate degree, which I believe was in cell biology. And then after that, you then decided to go to Turkmenistan. So talk to me about that. What happened there?
Sure. I actually think this is an example of what you'll see in a lot of folks who end up in aerospace medicine. The path is sometimes circuitous. So for me, right after university, I was working at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in what we call planetary protection, which is essentially biological quality assurance for any spacecraft we send to Mars or beyond, right? Like there's a certain set of guidelines depending on how involved the mission is, as to, you know, how many spores or what level of contamination a vehicle is allowed to have before landing on another planetary body. So after that mission launched, I was kind of, you know, getting introspective again, wondering how I wanted my career to develop. Did I want to go to graduate school? I was pretty certain from my research experience that that wasn't the path I wanted to pursue. And I had a few friends from high school who had joined the Peace Corps after their university experience. And Peace Corps offers a lot of different positions, one of which is a community health education volunteer. And I knew from doing that that I would gain a little bit more clinical experience. And that was essentially a way for me to confirm whether or not medicine was what I really wanted to do, right? I was going to have a lot of patient interactions, and I was going to be educating and providing care. And so that was really like the main driver behind my choosing to do Peace Corps. One of the unintended consequences, which is a positive for me coming out of that, is that, you know, Peace Corps was a little bit back then, at least, kind of like the lottery. And so you didn't necessarily get to pick where they send you to. I drew what some people might call the short straw and got sent to Central Asia, which is mostly post-Soviet territory. But the huge benefit there is that my host family spoke Russian. And so for 2 years, I spoke Russian, which for my current job, when I go to Star City and work with our Russian colleagues on International Space Station work, like it's a huge leg up for me. So things have a way of working out. Like I think everything happens for a reason. I absolutely loved my time in the Peace Corps. I think it gave me a huge shift in global perspective, right? I think in sometimes countries can get very egocentric and not think outside the box. And obviously I always like to say the I in ISS is my favorite part of working space station. And so that's kind of how Peace Corps fits into my career path. And I wouldn't trade it for anything.
So just for us who maybe aren't quite as familiar, can you explain a little bit, just a brief snippet about exactly what the Peace Corps is? Because that might not be a familiar term to other places around the globe may not actually have a similar organization. So it'd be really useful to hear about that, just in case anyone's wondering.
Sure. So the United States Peace Corps is a volunteer. It's actually a government agency. It was started by John F. Kennedy in the 60s. And essentially, it offers volunteers a 2-year tour of volunteer service in a number of developing countries around the world. Each host country can choose to request what types of volunteers or projects they want Americans to work on. But essentially, it's a way of creating projects that hopefully are sustainable in a way that help those countries continue to develop on their own. So there's a lot of international exchange, goodwill, but also, you know, education. In, you know, the sayings, teach a man to fish, that's sort of what's behind the mission of the Peace Corps. But a lot of volunteers will tell you they take so much more than what they feel they give during their volunteer experience. And I would say the same is true for me. A lot of people are like, oh, that's so selfless, you know, to give 2 years of your life up to helping others. But really, I think what you gain by doing it is just as, if not more, valuable.
Incredible. So Dr. Cho, you were talking about actually opportunities and things you'd actually gained from that experience. I couldn't help but notice when looking at your profile, you, I think around that sort of time, you actually spent some time at Star City at the Russian Space Medicine Summer School. Is that correct? Like, how did that come about when your time there as well?
That is correct. And that was a total fluke. The prior NASA internship I mentioned that I participated in during undergrad was called the NASA Academy. And much like the UTMB Aerospace Medicine Residency, the NASA Academy has a pretty strong alumni network. And that internship is available in different forms at various NASA centers in the US. And so obviously all of us are on an alumni email distribution list. And I got one of these distribution list emails while I was in the Peace Corps. And it was advertising this Russian space medicine and biology summer school in Moscow and in Star City. And it was a 2-week course that was offered at the time by what the Russians refer to as IBMP, the Institute for Biomedical Problems. It's essentially the Russian version of space medicine research. So being, you know, stationed in Turkmenistan at the time, it was a pretty short flight for me to get to Moscow. So I totally jumped at the opportunity. And it's funny how things come full circle, right? Because there I was in 2005, you know, getting a tour of Star City, not really knowing, but really, really hoping that several years down the road, I would return there to work for NASA and for the ISS program. And that is what happened. So I was super grateful for that opportunity. And obviously, you know, continue to work with those colleagues that I first got lectures from and met at a very early time in my career. So as I mentioned before, you know, things kind of have a way of working out and happening for a specific reason. And so that was just sort of the very first opening crack of that door you mentioned into aerospace medicine.
So just for anyone who maybe isn't as quite as familiar, what is Star City in Russia?
Yeah, that's a great point. So Star City, Russia is essentially where the Russian cosmonauts live and train. It would be analogous to Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, where NASA astronauts live and train.
And I understand that that's a slightly different place to where they launch from, right? Because you launch from Kazakhstan, is that correct?
Correct. And that actually is misconceptualized in the movie The Right Stuff, if anyone has seen that movie. So back during the space race days in the 60s, there's a scene where you see a Soyuz rocket launching, and there's a little subtext underneath that says Star City, Russia. Totally inaccurate. No rockets launch from Star City, Russia. Star City is actually maybe about 25 miles east of Moscow, where they actually launch Soyuz rockets from is Baikonur, Kazakhstan. That's about a 3-hour flight southeast of Moscow. So totally different country, but the Cosmodrome, as they call it, is that land is leased by the Russian government from Kazakhstan.
Gotcha. So you do your training as a cosmonaut in Star City, and then when you're actually going atop a Soyuz rocket, that's when you go from Kazakhstan and Baikonur, if I'm correct.
Correct.
I don't know if the pronunciation is correct there. Appreciate it. So then after that, if I continue with yourself, Dr. Cho, you then went and you started at the University of Michigan and you did your medical school there. Now, I've noticed in your profile that there's a mention of being a Cook Scholar, and I was interested where that fell into the whole process as well.
Sure. So the Cook Scholarship is named after Jack Kent Cook, who, as some folks may know, was a Canadian business entrepreneur as well as a philanthropist. At one point, he also owned several professional sports teams, including the Washington Redskins, which was a football team in the U.S., and he left behind a very strong legacy and scholarship program and foundation that specifically targets people who are interested in various forms of public service. And in the U.S., unlike a lot of other countries where, you know, medical school is subsidized or paid for by overarching government systems, in the U.S., it's like $250,000 essentially to attend med school. So I was looking for various scholarships and thought maybe the Cook Foundation might be something that I was eligible for. And incidentally, for undergraduate scholarships, it is available to international students. So check that out. I was lucky enough to receive a Cook scholarship to attend medical school. And for me, obviously, like, yes, there was a huge financial benefit to that. But one thing I would say as a Cook Scholar alumni is that for me, it was incredibly validating that the foundation found aerospace medicine what they thought was a unique form of public service, right? Because I was really interested in working with the federal government for the NASA program and doing what I think to them was a very unique job choice in terms of public service, but something that for me was super rewarding, something I had been looking to do for a very long time. And so I'm always very appreciative of them recognizing that and seeing the potential that I had.
Amazing. So that was what brought you then to medical school. And then I noticed that actually during medical school as well, you took advantage of certain opportunities that were offered at NASA to undertake a little bit more of a clerkship, I think it's referred to as well. And as far as I'm aware, that's still offered to people now, if I recall correctly from PASM, that a few people had either completed it or were in the process of completing it at the time.
The Aerospace Medicine Clerkship is an opportunity offered at NASA's Johnson Space Center twice a year for approximately 4 weeks each time. Individuals do need to apply for it in advance. There's a selection process that people will undergo. And if you're fortunate enough to get selected, you can come down to the NASA campus. I believe it's resumed in person now. Unfortunately, things changed due to the pandemic. But during that time, you will be connected with a mentor. So early on in advance, in terms of the preparatory work, a lot of strong work goes into this by very dedicated people to make this happen. And they will put a call out for mentors or researchers or, you know, folks at NASA to say, would you be able to come up with a project for these individuals to work on? And so very early on, you get paired up with that mentor, you get assigned a project or task, and you work on that in parallel during your time at Johnson Space Center. But then you also receive a variety of lectures on spaceflight operations. And of course, while you are on the campus, you get to get some really neat behind the scenes tours. And the final days of the clerkship, you will then present the work that you have done in a large forum. So it's a really just a spectacular opportunity for individuals to get a little bit more close to the NASA campus, some face time with mentors. I often get asked, what is the difference between the course UTMB offers in July and the clerkship? And I said, it's like a Venn diagram. There is some overlap that goes into this in terms of content, but then there are unique facets that make each one a great experience. So doing one, I don't think stands in lieu of the other. I feel there is an additive experience that comes through. So if you're fortunate to be able to do both, fantastic.
I think there's also another thing we can add there as well is that as far as I'm aware, one of the things that I remember hearing when I was on PASM is that the clerkship is exclusively, I don't know if it's changed, but exclusively US citizens, whereas PASM or Principles of Aviation and Space Medicine is an international course as well, which may also influence which one you choose for.
Well, that is a very good point. When it comes to the clerkship, you can fact check me on this, but I do believe you are right that you must be either a US citizen or a green card holder. The requirements are stipulated in the application process. For the UTMB course, we do allow folks who are international to apply, and we have a very strong percentage of that class composition that hails from different countries, which is why, jokingly, whenever I give a lecture, I always say good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending where
it's
you want to
go. It's completely true. You need to do it. You need to do it. I remember one... There was somebody email coming in from Australia, and we could see the sun go down at the start of the day and the sun go up at the end of his day. And it's true. It was so international.
I always appreciate that level of commitment. It's one of the values I think that was instilled into me by my parents. Work hard, you know, probably a lot of stories I could tell, but I will not. But working hard as an ethic is something I believe in. And when you see folks who are committed like that, you know, flipping their sleep schedules, I respect that. And the folks who are international really appreciate this opportunity, again, because the opportunities to learn like this are very limited. Now, we do have to sometimes constrain our content. So all of our speakers are informed that there are international folks listening in. And the content of what they can share sometimes does get impacted. But nonetheless, you know, if you walk away, you don't realize that because there's just so much information and experiences to be shared with the group as a whole. I do get asked a lot the question of what we will be doing in 2023. So before you ask, the answer is we do not know. Our faculty and I are discussing this. The folks who are domestic would love to be able to come down to Houston. The folks who are international, the majority, I think, appreciate the ability to have that from afar. So we will see.
I'm really interested to know if there's any overlap or communication or partnership with any of your European partners, any of your academic institutions in Europe or Australia. Is there anything happening or on the horizon at all?
That is a great question. We have been contacted by a number of institutions from a number of different countries. Out of respect of privacy, I will not say which countries, which institutions, but suffice to say, we are trying to figure out ways to work together to create something that is meaningful. It is so easy to say, yeah, we're working together. What does that mean? You know, a degree of accountability. What does that mean? What can we offer? And is it something of utility that is then of value to the people who are devoting the time?
So this is a question to both of you. We hear this term flight surgeon being chucked around quite a lot. And there's also other terms that can get a little bit confusing for people, such as aerospace medicine examiners as well. Is it possible for you to be able to say what exactly a flight surgeon is and why that differs from some of the other terms that you hear around?
Yeah, that's always a great question. And actually, if we can, I'd like to start by asking you, what do you understand a flight surgeon to be? And then I can...
Ooh,
I can,
that's good. I like that.
Yeah.
That's a question chucked back at you.
There's a lot of mystique about it. And quite frankly, sometimes we don't totally understand why.
Right.
You know, when we get questions and interest, which is great, but I'm just kind of curious what the conception is from your perspective. And I can speak to that afterwards.
Yes. Yeah. No, I just wanted to answer this question first, because I think I've really wrestled with this definition a lot since, you know, I entered the space. So for me, I think a flight surgeon is someone who has a specialist understanding and has some sort of training in how aviation and altitude affects physiology and how it affects sort of clinical physiology in terms of disease and things like that, and then has a effect on the operational side as well when it comes to occupational health, and actually works in the space as well. So it's one thing actually understanding it, and it's the next thing actually working, actually functioning in a role in that space. So I think if a doctor, clinician does those two things, then they are a flight surgeon. So I mean to say that this should be cross borders and it should be in different organizations, so not just in the military. If they're using those skills and they have a role that they do that, then they are a flight surgeon. But maybe I'm wrong.
And then, Rowan, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, no. I mean, to me, I feel like it's a sort of role or a job title which is defined by specific organizations, which is specifically related to somebody who is employed primarily in the sector of aviation medicine to be able to assist people who are either flight crew, either astronauts or by pilots, in order to optimize them for the purposes of their mission. That to me is kind of like a catch-all definition for that.
So historically speaking, a flight surgeon is a physician with some degree of aerospace medicine knowledge. So they're not always a specialist, and I'll get into that in a little bit, but they have some degree of aerospace medicine knowledge, and they provide direct medical care in an operational capacity, typically, to pilots and astronauts. So for example, and obviously I'm going to speak more to, you know, how things work in the U.S., but in the United States Air Force, it's a six-week course, and the UTMB residents actually go through this Air Force course as well. So they complete that. And then if you're in the United States Navy, it's a 6-month course. And typically at the end of that course education, you're awarded wings, just like a pilot is. So it's an official ceremony to denote the end of that training and to give you the actual designation or job title of flight surgeon. So it should be noted that it's possible, at least again, using this example of the U.S. military, to be a flight surgeon without aerospace medicine residency or, you know, the international equivalent of specialty training. Okay. So that's right, a very important distinction. However, those who do complete a formal aerospace medicine residency or the, you know, international equivalent, are generally considered to be experts in the field because they have the most specialty training. And therefore, they tend to be appointed into leadership roles with more responsibility, more decision-making capacity, more supervision of junior flight surgeons, for example, or folks who just took the 6-week or a 6-month course. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So generally, generally speaking, NASA and most commercial space companies right now, at least, are taking a conservative approach of defining a flight surgeon as someone who has completed both formal aerospace medicine specialty training through a residency or its international equivalent, and some form of on-the-job coursework or training like the ones I described above, the shorter, you know, several weeks or several months course. So ultimately, having both of those, right, opens you up to the most job opportunities. Conversely, you can be an aerospace medicine specialist, right, having completed specialty training, as I mentioned above, but not have the function or the job designation of a flight surgeon.
Gotcha.
For example, you complete aerospace medicine specialty training or residency, but your primary function is to be involved in aerospace medicine research. So that can mean, you know, you've trained in aerospace medicine, but you've never actually laid hands on an astronaut or a pilot or supported a launch or landing in an operational capacity. So it's important to understand not only somebody's educational background, but also what their day-to-day on-the-job experience is. Does that help clear things up a little bit?
That's super comprehensive. So basically, a flight surgeon seems to be somebody who has obviously got some element of training within aerospace medicine, and has passed, in particular in the US, a particular course to be able to give them flight surgeon designation. But the exact depth of their training is dependent upon where they necessarily are employed, because whether or not they have a residency is not necessarily going to determine their status as a flight surgeon. It depends upon which institution or which organization they're employed by as to what the requirements are to be in a flight surgeon within that organization. Is that a correct summary?
Yeah. So it definitely does depend on what institution or organization you work for. So the military has their own system. You know, NASA has their own system. Commercial space is still trying to figure out, you know, generally what their system is. Most companies are adopting, you know, what NASA has done in the past, just so there's no need to reinvent the wheel. But yeah, it sometimes it can vary.
And can I clarify, if someone does that same exact job, and has the same level of specialist understanding and skills and qualification, but does not have that title in a role, let's say in another country where that title does not exist, can they still call themselves a flight surgeon?
In the absence of definition, people can, for better or for worse, can say what they'd like to say, right? You're talking about, you know, we work within the context of a system where the scope is defined. Right? It's established. So we know what the criteria are for saying something. I think it's beneficial for those countries with emerging and developing programs to proactively define these things so that you build that structure and you know what it takes. Because again, it comes down to really taking care of your patients. So it's much like anything else we do in any other medical specialty. What is the definition of a cardiologist or an anesthesiologist?
Yep.
But more so, it's also, what is the scope of responsibility? So to answer your question, Daniel, if they say they are a flight surgeon, who is there to stop them, right? It really does come down to building that structure so someone can say it and it means something. I think that's what it really comes down to, is saying it so you can define it and mean it. If you come through as an international and you go through all the training through an existing program, then you can say, yes, I'm a flight surgeon as defined by X. I'm a flight surgeon as defined by Y. And I think it's important to give that context.
I think this is the first time that I've come across a solid discussion where we're trying to define the word and the name, the job title, with a lot of knowledge and expertise behind it. So I think this actually means a lot. So I'm really grateful for, you know, for you guys actually defining that. And actually, it will go a long way in my conversations and definitely to my junior colleagues, because we often debate this a lot. So really grateful for that.
I think the other thing to add on is that we would no way advocate anyone calling themselves something that they haven't actually been defined as doing. That's it at the end of the day. Like, unless you've had been told by an organization which is reputed that you're a flight surgeon, you can't go around and call yourself that because of the risk that could be misidentified or misconstrued in terms of what qualifications you actually do have.
Yes, it's a very small community, right? And so whether or not folks are aware, we notice these things. Mm-hmm. And that type of behavior, obviously, the misrepresentation or statements that can be a little bit misleading speaks to, you know, the ethics of the individual or an institution as a whole. So those things are noticed. And again, because it is a small community, it does get on people's radars and can definitely create some opinions that can be detrimental for folks going forward.
I really agree, but I think as defined by, you know, the depth of this conversation, there was clearly some ambiguity. So maybe that's something, you know, which is being addressed clearly by this conversation and in future should be, because, you know, clearly people are using that job title wrongly.
Yeah, I would say, much to the consternation of many people who have been in this field, the behaviors that Dr. Cho has described do exist. And our philosophy for the university we represent is not to be disparaging or negative towards the others, but to simply make it even more well known what the right thing to do is, the right way to go is, what it is that we can offer for those who are genuinely interested in learning. So we stay on a positive track, take the high road.
Perfect. Thanks for clarifying all of that. So as somebody, I think somebody mentioned a little bit earlier, both yourself, Dr. Shah, and Dr. Cho, you've taken slightly different olive branches from that initial start after the aerospace medicine residency. Dr. Shah, you've gone especially down the managerial road as time at Johnson Space Center and the medical director, whereas Dr. Cho, you've kind of stayed within the trenches as in operations especially and been assigned to various different missions. I'm sure that a lot of people would be interested in both of those stories, but Dr. Cho, if you don't mind telling me, what's it like being assigned to a mission and what does that actually mean in terms of the various prep work that you have to do?
Yeah, so when you get assigned to a mission, some of the first things you start doing are attending medical-related training for your crew member. So as folks may know, there's no requirement right now for a physician to be on board in space on the space station with crew. So a lot of the medical training that we attend pre-flight for our crew members is dealing with, you know, teaching them how to do CPR in space on a worst case scenario day, right? It's not going to be the same as you do it on the Earth due to reduced gravity. We also attend, they learn how to start their own IVs, draw blood on themselves and each other for research purposes, how to put in sutures if needed, those types of minor medical care, but acute medical care type situations. The other thing that we do pre-flight is meet with them and talk about any minor or chronic medical issues that they are dealing with and what our game plan is for, you know, how to prevent flare-ups of that in space, how to address acute flare-ups in case they do occur in space. You know, you always want to have a backup plan. And then we also attend some of what we call hazardous training that they perform. So some folks may have seen pictures of the NBL, the Neutral Buoyancy Lab at NASA. That's the giant pool, essentially, where our crew members practice their spacewalks. So that's what a component of what we consider hazardous training, because they're pressurized in the suit, right? And aerospace medicine specialists are trained to deal with hyper and hypobaric environments. And so any sort of situation where they are exposed to a quote unquote extreme environment like that, we attend to be able to address any acute medical issues that happen during that time. During mission, to be honest, we live in a red tape bureaucratic palace, so we attend a lot of meetings. But beyond the meetings that support International Space Station, which is a very complex vehicle, right? We are monitoring our crew members. They don't have continuous telemetry like we did back in the early days. But weekly, we meet with them on a video conference for what we call a PMC or a private medical conference. And so that's a 15-minute medical time where we get to discuss any issues that the crew members want to talk about with us.
Okay, great. So I just wanted to clarify something. You talked about things you do pre-mission and we've said you've been assigned to a mission. Are you assigned to a particular crew member or are you assigned to the mission in general?
That's a good question. And the answer actually right now, at least, depends on what vehicle we're talking about. So for Soyuz, you are typically only assigned one crew member, sometimes two, but obviously you're only assigned to the NASA crew members that are flying on that vehicle. Sure. So in my case right now, I am assigned to a single crew member that is flying on Soyuz with two other Russians. When it comes to talking about SpaceX Dragon, if it's an all-American crew, all four of those crew members are yours and your deputy. So typically it's two NASA flight surgeons are assigned to a NASA crew, whether that's a single crew member or an entire vehicle.
Thank you so much for that clarification. And then you were talking then, I interrupted you actually, but you were talking a little bit about what it was like when your particular crew members or crew members are actually assigned on station. And a lot of that time seems to be involved in meetings, but I suppose there might be some times when you're like at the mission control like console or something like that. Is that the case or not really?
Yeah, exactly. So when we're not attending meetings, and we break this up, you know, who's covering console which week, who's covering meetings, etc. So if it's a week where I'm sitting console, I'm looking at the our crew members' schedule. And for people who are planners, you would love this schedule because their crew day is broken up into 5-minute increments. So literally every 5 minutes of your day, every day is planned out for you. but in that entire crew day, right, they have a certain number of work hours. It's typically 6.5 that they are allowed to work based on pre-existing mission rules. And so we try as the docs to be an advocate to not bust those duty hours the same way that we do for pilots or for in the U.S. medical system for residents, right? They should only be working a certain amount of hours per week to maintain work-life balance, to mitigate fatigue, et cetera, which because as you guys know, in aerospace medicine, human factors and human errors are a big issue. Sleep is a big problem in space because you don't have your typical circadian cues, right? They've got sunsets and sunrises happening every 45 minutes. It can be really confusing for folks' sleep hormones and their brain. And so trying to make sure that they don't have excessive tasks on their plate that can contribute to stress or that creep into their weekends, which should remain more or less open, is something else that we try and advocate for during mission when we're looking at the schedule. And then, of course, one of the biggest things that we support during mission are EVAs or extravehicular activities, otherwise known as spacewalks. I would say from an aeromedical standpoint, this is the most dangerous thing that we ask crew members to do, right? Is open the door and go outside into the vacuum of space. And so, as you can imagine, there's a lot of preventive aerospace medicine that happens in that regard with respect to conducting appropriate pre-breathe protocols to make sure that they don't develop decompression sickness due to the pressure changes that occur when you're dealing with a pressurized suit. If there's a leak in the suit, there's a lot of safety that's built in and that goes into those days. And those are very long days, both for the crew on orbit and the support team on the ground. So that's a little bit about what we do in flight. And then post-mission, there's this meme that I've seen online where people, you know, ask each other, describe what you do badly and have people try and guess what you do. So my joke about my job is I get my patients really, really high. And when they come back down, I put them in rehab. And that's, you know, tongue in cheek, but that is essentially what happens when they come back to Earth. Because even though we have really great, what we call countermeasures to mitigate muscle and bone loss, that's one of our strongest countermeasures, right, is the exercise component when you're in space. There's still some neurovestibular and some balance issues that they have. And so all of that is very interesting to the research side of the community. But it's also very important for them to recondition themselves and use these tiny little muscle fibers like in your spinal column that haven't been used in 6 months, right? It's kind of like the bedridden patients we see on Earth. And so post-mission is a lot of research data collection that we support just in case crew aren't feeling well that day and they're still readapting to 1G. But then it's also following them through their rehabilitation program, which is at a minimum 6 weeks when they come back to Earth. And it's essentially just being around to support that and trying to mitigate any sort of smoldering musculoskeletal and other issues that may be going on post-flight.
I think one of the things I'm really taking from aspects of your job actually is that when you say that you're acting as the advocate of that crew member, you really are, because you're the one actually defending them from being overworked, overtired, making sure that they're safe in terms of what they do, both pre and post. And it makes a real kind of, you all must have read the right stuff. And I just remember thinking about the relationship described between pilots and their flight surgeons back in the day, in which you almost didn't want to tell the flight doc, because the best case scenario is that best case scenario is you stay as you are, the worst case is that you get grounded. But it kind of seems like that's changed, but it seems like you're working much more together to be able to get that combined solution. And I think that's really nice from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I will say at NASA, things are much different than they were back in the military days, as you're alluding to. Like, it was much more adversarial, especially with this particular generation of crew members. I have found it's much more collaborative. They understand that we are essentially there to keep them flying as much as possible. And, you know, that makes sense, right? Because NASA invests a lot of taxpayer dollars when they initially select these people. And so it's a lot more cost effective to retain those individuals that are already, we've already invested in, and maintain them flying to the extent possible based on air medical standards and preventive health.
Dr. Cho, you've obviously talked to us about a huge amount of the aspects of your job. And if I could ask you to name some of the best bits and then actually some of the more challenging aspects of your job to somebody who's maybe considering a similar career, and maybe Dr. Shah, you want to chip in here as well. What would you describe those as being?
So the best parts, to summarize it, as a colleague often does, it's like taking care of Lewis and Clark. So for me, like, I'm just excited to be a part of the team. It's cool to me. It's to know that, you know, I have helped someone jump through hoops that, as you mentioned earlier, Rohan, like, can be kind of annoying from like a historic military perspective in a previously adversarial role. But to work as a team and help the best of us explore on behalf of humanity, that's the most rewarding part for me, for sure. The most challenging part, I would say, is just space is hard, right? NASA has been doing it for like 60 years, and there's still stuff that we have questions about. And, you know, we always say in research, when you find an answer, it just creates more questions. And that's the case. So imagine now putting yourself in a commercial space community and answering some questions that, you know, maybe NASA answered in the past, but you're now learning the lessons of just for the first time. So space is incredibly hard. Even ISS, which has been around for 20 years, is an incredibly complex vehicle. And we are continuing every day to learn more and more, despite having done this for several decades already. So that's always continually going to be a challenge, just working in an environment that has very clear physical limitations.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cho, for explaining that. Dr. Shah, you've gone a slightly different tangent. You are a director at Johnson Space Center, and now you've joined the Aerospace Medicine Residency as their director. Can you tell me a little bit about what your day-to-day or week-to-week life looks like, and what the challenges and best parts are of that?
I could jokingly say sometimes I wonder what it's like from an hour-to-hour basis. So I spent almost a decade working at NASA's Johnson Space Center in various capacities. And so I actually started off with NASA's human research program, something called the Exploration Medical Capability Team. And then after that, I transitioned to more of an operational role where I provided direct support to the crew at the Neutral Buoyancy Lab. I also did a tour in Star City. And then in 2017, I had the privilege of being selected to become the next medical director for the Johnson Space Center Clinic. And the clinic itself is an umbrella term which encompassed almost 10 different entities. So one, you know, I'm not going to ramble off all of them, but suffice to say, all of these different entities comprise together, it's the aggregate of the healthcare system, if you will, for our nation's astronaut corps. And what I've always enjoyed is I've always enjoyed the technical, but I've also enjoyed very much so seeing how each piece interfaces with the other and how you all the pieces really just fit together and you try to steer things one way or in one direction. And allowing individuals to know that all of them play an important part. The cliched saying of the chains, the links in a chain, right? Everyone plays a strong role. And I have always enjoyed that particular facet. The size of the team at NASA was almost, give or take, 80 people of all different skill sets, backgrounds, experiences. And so that diversity was always just a fun part. It was always fun to be a part of that. And so when you asked the question earlier of what are the best parts or the more challenging parts, to me, the best part is simply being able to partake in something where you believe in the mission, you believe in the vision. And it's so easy because for us, we just have to look up. And quite literally, there are evenings where you can look up in the Houston sky and see the International Space Station flying over. And so despite all the politics or the red tape or the bureaucracy, you can look up and say, you know what? Look at that. It is such an incredible feat to be able to look up and say you're part of something. And that to me is probably one of the most personally and professionally rewarding aspects of this job all throughout. I would say the more challenging part is just the accumulation of separate tasks. As Dr. Cho mentioned, there's so many things you go through, whether it be on a day-to-day, week-to-week, or hour-to-hour basis, that you will get pulled in so many directions. And for the most part, you will have, for the most part, the technical capability or know-how of how to address something. But it is the aggregate of all of these things put together that becomes challenging. When it comes to the, I think the second part that's also challenging is then in the technical side, like I said, most things you know, but the application of what you know technically and adapting it to the spaceflight environment, the pandemic being a great example. Whereas all of the healthcare institutions around the world were looking at policies on an Earth-based system, we're the only ones looking at this from a spacefaring system. The people we need are part of a critical infrastructure. How do you modify protocols to reduce pre-flight risk of contracting COVID, right? How do you protect the crew when they come back home, when they're temporarily immunosuppressed when they land, right? So thinking about all of these aspects operationally was huge for us. And in itself, I could joke, is another podcast. But it took a tremendous amount of teamwork, which comes back to the best part. Belief in the mission, belief in the vision, and being part of this incredible team of individuals to accomplish something. But, you know, Rohan, you asked me about management. And again, it's something I've always enjoyed. And when I spent 5 years at NASA's Johnson Space Center, tremendous amount of experience working there. But I've also had a passion for education. And leaving NASA was not an easy choice. It was very hard. I spent a lot of time thinking about it because I miss the people. I miss everything I just spoke about. But then I think about where the future of this field is going and education specifically. I say, I enjoy that. How can I be a part of that? How can I lend my skill sets to that? And what team do we need to propel the education in this field forward? So for me, that was the compelling reason to come to UTMB.
And that actually really nicely leads me on to some of the things that I want to talk to you guys about as well, which is the future of aerospace medicine. Now, I think Dr. Shah, you've actually said to me yourself, and you kind of alluded to it here, that you guys are going to be constructing the course for the future aerospace medicine physicians to be able to basically be qualified and competent to be able to act in the future of aerospace medicine. And that's a sector which is changing almost on a day-by-day basis. We've got International Space Station, which has kind of been sort of the old, and now we're seeing Dragon. We're now seeing other commercial spaceflight companies who are taking up that role and putting people into space. I guess the question really is, where do you see aerospace medicine going in the future, and how do you prepare your course to be able to encounter challenges that you may not even be able to fathom right now?
I can take a first crack at this one. That is a very, very loaded question, which we could decompose into so many pieces. But the first thing to say is part of the reason that Drs. Cho and Krakis were identified to join the team is diversity. diversity of background, training, skill set, thought, to help come together at the table and say, where does this go? We are not a field that can, you know, where we are one of 100 and that we can copy templates off of 99 others. Really, we try to lead from the front. And so the question has to be, what is our vision? What do we believe in? And the vision we have put forth is that we believe wholeheartedly, we believe in the success of any individual who desires to travel to the skies. And the skies is broad. It could be 3,000 feet, 30,000 feet, 300 miles, 300,000 miles. It's really, that's the whole spectrum of aerospace. And so we sit down and we think about where is the mission? Where is someone going? What is the nature of that mission? Where are they going? What craft are they in? How long is that mission? And one of the first things I will say is, in terms of how we're trying to adapt our training curriculum, is recognizing that, as we always have, that being a solid clinician is necessary so that you can then better understand the aeromedical risk involved in sending people into space. People historically have looked at spaceflight and said, it's how healthy can you be? That has changed. I jokingly say, it's how unhealthy can you be? And that is where we see part of the future. So again, there are many different aspects of which private company or federal entity is going where, right? We know NASA has their mission to the ISS. They have the Artemis, return to the moon. We have other companies with suborbital flights. We have other companies with their eyes set on Mars. So everyone has a different destination. And that mission then relates backwards into what do we need to train our physicians to know and understand. One thing that we can expect to see in the future is the involvement of sending people with disabilities into space. So the question then becomes, what does it take to send someone with, say, a prosthesis or perhaps short stature, maybe significant scoliosis or arrhythmias? Choose what you want, but what does it take to safely send this person for a suborbital flight, a three-day orbital, a three-month, what type of excursion, whatever it may be? What does it take to get that person up there? So we start with that because, again, the best risk reduction you will have is through prevention on the ground. But then that segues into, now this person's certified, what is the in-flight risk that this person may experience, right? If you take someone, for example, with a short stature or someone with a prosthesis, is the seat that he or she is going to sit on going to be the same as everyone else? Is the egress protocol is going to be the same as everyone else? What so many changes may need to happen. And then you start thinking about human factors, you start thinking about the engineering. So these are all aspects that we are trying to fold into our educational curriculum.
I remember in a previous interview, actually, Dr. Cho, when you had said that sometimes it's a bit difficult because as an aerospace medicine physician, especially in an environment such as NASA, you are faced with groups of engineers and actually you're a bit of a medical consultant who has to kind of bridge the gap between medicine, which is quite a lot of it was qualitative, to maybe the more quantitative world of engineering. How do you actually bridge that gap to be able to communicate with these other colleagues? Or is it actually much easier than you would initially think?
You're right. In medicine, we often employ, we have quantitative training, but qualitative attributes to it. When you're working with engineers, I think more importantly, not just engineers, but anyone else, you need to recognize how to communicate with these individuals. And first things first is understanding, what are they looking for? What is the end product that they seek? Is the end product that what they seek a quantitative descriptor or something solid that they can relate to? If that's the case, then you have to work to that, right? That's how engineering specifications are. But it's also important to be able to relate to them the impact of what you're asking for and why you're asking for it. Okay, I think a lot gets lost there, actually, is we just want something, but more importantly, why are we asking for it? And then being able to delineate very clearly, these are the consequences, right? And work from that standpoint. In itself, answering this question is like trying to give a quantitative answer to a qualitative question. How do you form the framework of a conversation? And there's definitely an art to that where it's real time, right? So you can go in and teach people some of the skill sets of what to listen for, what to look for, and then framework your conversation that way, which, by the way, one of the things that we're trying to help better educate our residents on is things just like this. How do you have medical to non-medical conversations?
You know, put another way, you have to bound the questions. If anyone has read the book Packing for Mars by Mary Roach, she actually addresses this pretty clearly. And she's like, humans are the most annoying part of human spaceflight for an engineer, because there are so many variabilities from individual to individual. And so when engineering says, you know, how much water do we need to bring for this mission? Okay, well, how long is the mission? First of all, obviously. You know, what are the hygiene constraints based on the waste hazard compartment that y'all have designed? You know, generally speaking, what are the anthropometric limits to individuals? Because that can give you a better estimation of body surface area and water usage, etc. So there are ways to create limits to what type of question is being asked and kind of go from there. And then the one other technique obviously that we use is, well, what's published in the terrestrial literature that we can use as an analog when it comes to medical architecture of a system for a vehicle? What medications do we need to bring? Okay, well, what about maybe submarine populations? Is that something that we could use as an analog? Or populations living in Antarctica, resource-limited environments where similar questions have been asked? And so if you go from what's already been established, which obviously sometimes in spaceflight is hard, you can further bound those questions and then, you know, bound the scope of what's being asked, if that makes sense.
And how does one actually go and develop those strategies? I mean, you obviously have got some data from a very, very healthy population that you've had at NASA or maybe Roscosmos or the relevant other astronaut organizations. But how does one take a pathological issue and then say, actually, yeah, this is going to be fine in spaceflight, or this is going to be not so fine in spaceflight?
It's a multi-pronged answer. Part of it is based on historical precedent. What we have seen, I remember having the opportunity to speak with some of the flight surgeons from the Apollo era, and I asked the same question, how did you know? And the answer was very simple and very blunt. The answer was, we didn't. Right? There are some areas where you do not have baseline data for comparison. So a good example modern day is there is research that is soon to be published, hopefully, that took laypersons and put them inside of a centrifuge and expose them to various G-forces on the different axes to understand what happens. Can they tolerate this? And some of this has never been done before. So to answer your question, part of this is benchmark of what we've known through historical experience. NASA has a great repository of experience over the past several decades, and we do pull on some of our folks who work at NASA to help educate the future residents, teaching them what they've seen and they've learned. We do have models for example, the IMM, the Integrated Medical Model, is something that NASA has developed over many years, and other types of quantitative modeling to help learn and understand that. So you can translate something qualitative and translate into something quantitative to the best of our ability. The other thing you benchmark off is what we have learned from the U.S. military. And so you look into their historical precedent, you talk with colleagues in the field, and then of course, there's the X factor, the part that we just don't know. You can look at ongoing research and propose new research to be done so that can help inform future. But for present day, you try not to do this in a vacuum. And what that means is sometimes you'll sit down in a medical boardroom. You might be the chief medical officer and surrounded by those who are advising you. You might be in a boardroom where each person has a say in the matter. And Dr. Cho and I have had the experience of sitting in on such discussions. So Dr. Cho, you wanted to chime in on this as well.
Sure. Yeah. The Air Medical Board, you know, case presentations, it's kind of the way I explain it to folks outside of our community is that it's kind of like going to court, right? Like you come and you bring all the data that you have available to make your case, but you're right. There are some unknowns, even outside of military and maybe even civil aviation data that we can lean back on. So in the training period leading up to the flight, something else you can do, right, is test a certain medical condition in other sort of stressful or extreme or remote environments. So how do they do in a centrifuge? How do they do if we don't have centrifuge data? How do they do in like a remote wilderness or backpacking course, right? Like if it's a joint issue, obviously you're going to have that joint tested under more stressful circumstances. And then obviously we rely on the opinions and the inputs from our specialty consultants. If it's an orthopedic issue, if it's a cardiovascular issue, right? Like they have a lot of really sage advice based on other patients that they may have seen with similar conditions and can speak, you know, in more detail than us as preventive medicine specialists on whether or not the stressors of spaceflight would incur a risk for a given individual. So a lot of these discussions are very case by case, but something that's been coming up more in our air medical board discussions about commercial spaceflight participants is what is the cumulative risk, right? A lot of these individuals are older. They obviously don't meet stricter military or NASA or FAA standards. And so every time you waive a condition, in other words, you're allowing that condition to fly in space with, you know, appropriate preventive measures, appropriate contingency measures. It's good that you have a plan in place and to show that something is well controlled, but that's just one condition. What if there are multiple conditions that have been waived, right? And so that's sort of the open-ended question is at what point does the cumulative risk for that mission overall, when you multiply that by 4 or 6 or 7 crew members, become too much? And then obviously something happens. Yeah, it's about appropriately assessing the risk at hand and buying down the probability as much as you can based on the data that you do have. And, you know, one of my mentors when I was in training said it best, I think, and that is, if there is a doubt, then there is no doubt. So if there's something in your mind that's like, well, okay, you know, yes, we've done X, Y, Z, but I'm still uncomfortable. My gut instinct is uncomfortable with this. That just as an ER doc, you know, that's sort of something that I tend to rely on as much as the data.
Yeah, there's something I would like to add on to what Dr. Cho is saying, and that takes us back to the question you had asked just a moment ago about where is the future of aerospace medicine? Something to think about is the nature of medical support and infrastructure you will have on those future missions, and that plays into the level of acceptable risk as we think about it. Right? Are we talking about telemedicine? Are we talking about telemedicine with communication delay, autonomous medical operations, the capabilities you would have for the acute treatment of an injury or an illness that occurs on orbit or whatever mission you have? So you ask the question of the future of this field, but it dovetails nicely with the level of acceptable risk that we think about before sending someone.
And that's a good point, actually. I hadn't necessarily thought about that, but of course it would make sense. Like, actually, what is your contingency would definitely be inversely proportional, I suppose, to the level of risk you're willing to accept. That makes actually complete sense, which I hadn't thought about before.
Just off the tail of that, in the aviation, the commercial aviation community, there's a 1% rule, which pertains to pilots of commercial aviation. Does that have a parallel in aerospace?
Yeah, we do, especially from a cardiovascular standpoint. We love the 1% rule as well. So yes, we try and keep everything as low risk as possible. If 1% is feasible for the particular condition at hand, then absolutely that's a benchmark that we tend to use.
Amazing. I think this has been an absolutely wonderful discussion. We've covered so much stuff throughout the entire talk. Started talking about your different, but obviously very intertwined and connected careers, and then especially moving on to how to take maximum advantage of opportunities, and then going into how you guys as the pioneers really of aerospace medicine education are going to be shaping that education path, as well as where you see the future of aerospace medicine going. It's been a wonderful conversation. I really do thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you both for inviting us, for sharing your platform for us to share our message. And we're very excited about the future of this field. It seems that both of you are as well. So thank you for doing what you're doing. We hope it's of value to your audience.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hey everyone, thanks for downloading and listening to our podcast. We hope that you gained a lot from it.
And if you'd like to hear some more stuff like this and much more, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you found this on. And if you like what you heard, drop us a rating too.
You can also give us a follow on our social media accounts. We are at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And once again, that's at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter.
Also, we'd like to hear your feedback, of course, improve. So let us know your thoughts by emailing us at aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com. That's aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com.
Until next time, though, thanks so much again for listening. Stay safe, keep aiming high, and we will see you very, very soon.